Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Yeah, thank you for coming to this event on the Young Wittgenstein, for braving the cold this evening. Tonight we're going to engage with one of the most interesting and admittedly complex philosophical figures of the 20th century. So now I'll introduce our panel. So starting at the other side, Ian Ground, a philosopher and adult education specialist. He's taught philosophy at institutions such as Newcastle, Durham and the Open University. He's currently a research fellow in philosophy at the University of Hertfordshire, also teaching at Newcastle University. His research encompasses philosophy of art, animal cognition, and the life and thought of Wittgenstein. Publications include Art or Bunk, Can We Understand Animal Minds, and Portraits of Wittgenstein, newly available in paperback. He also writes for the TLS and is vice president of the British Wittgenstein Society. Sean Tejedor is associate professor in philosophy at the University of Valencia and senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Hertfordshire. Her research focuses on topics such as Wittgenstein, the philosophy of language, and the philosophy of science and ethics. Two recent books of hers are The Early Wittgenstein on Metaphysics, Natural Science, Language and Value, that's Routledge, 2015, and Starting with Wittgenstein. Stephen Mulhall is a professor and fellow of philosophy at New College, Oxford. His research interests are in Wittgenstein's philosophy and in key figures in the Franco-German post-Kantian traditions. Here, he's especially interested in Heidegger, Sartre, Nietzsche, and Kierkegaard, and their critical engagement with Anglo-American philosophy. Recent publications include The Great Riddle, Wittgenstein and Nonsense, Theology and Philosophy, and the third edition of his book on film. Okay, so to get started, Ian, could you be so kind as to give us some sense of what kind of background Wittgenstein had or where he comes from.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. Okay, so London, February the 7th, 2018. Let's take a trip about 1,000 miles to the east and exactly 100 years back in time. And we find ourselves pretty much on the Russian front, which is relatively quiet at that time. The Russians are in kind of revolutionary disarray. If we look carefully, we'll find there a young man, 28 years old, medium height, rather intense look. 6 days ago, he was made a lieutenant in the Austrian army, and he's perhaps looking forward to being sent on a flying course the next day, building on intense interest that he's had in aeronautics that led him to study in Berlin, and Manchester, and fly kites in Glossop in Yorkshire. And it was as a result of grappling with the mathematics of torque and propellers and jet engines that he got interested in mathematics, and then in the foundations of mathematics, and then in philosophy. And if we look in his coat pockets, we will find perhaps a copy of Tolstoy's Gospels, and also his own notebooks in which he writes his thoughts on logic, philosophy, but increasingly now on death and life and God and value. His name is Ludwig Wittgenstein. On February the 7th, there are many things he doesn't know. One thing he doesn't know is that in 9 months' time, despite improvising a mortar from a tree trunk and brass wire to defend himself, he'll be captured by the Italians and become a POW for the rest of the war. Not very long, actually. That's actually one day before the Italians sign the armistice that he's captured. He doesn't know either, of course he doesn't know, that 100 years later, the thoughts on logic and philosophy that he has in his coat pocket, and almost everything he writes during this period and everything he'll go on to write, will be declared a UNESCO a World Heritage status that happened just last year. There are some things, of course, he does know or thinks that he knows. He knows, he thinks, that he has solved all the foundational problems of philosophy. He knows also, he thinks, that everything he has written in solving those problems is fundamentally unimportant compared to what he thinks really matters. So explaining that is what we're about tonight, I think. Ludwig was born in Vienna in 1889 into a Viennese family of huge wealth based on steel and arms and banking in a vast and luxurious so-called Palais Wittgenstein in Vienna. He was the youngest of three sisters and four brothers. They were all in different ways extraordinarily talented and all in different ways victims of their very overbearing father, Karl. One thing that held them all together, must be said, was music. The Palais Wittgenstein was visited regularly by people like Strauss, Brahms, Clara Schumann, Mahler at least once, and Bruno Walter. Ludwig himself began learning the piano but gave it up, either because he was badly taught or because of the ferociously high standards set by his brother, especially Hans, actually. Ludwig, or Lucky, as he was known in the family, was schooled at home, first of all, and then at school in Linz, where he was an unhappy and not very successful student. He briefly overlapped, infamously, with someone the same age as him, but 2 years down in school, one Adolf Hitler. After school, he went off to study engineering in Berlin and in Manchester, and became increasingly interested in the foundation of mathematics and logic. In 1911, which is rather extraordinary, he took himself off to Jena to meet the great logician of the age, Frege, and talk to Frege. Frege recommended that he go to Cambridge and study under, as a guest student, with Bertrand Russell. This is exactly what he did, extraordinary thing for a young man like that to do. He is actively involved in intellectual life in Cambridge, of course, discussing with figures like Russell and Keynes, Whitehead and Hardy. In 1913, on his father's death, he inherits a huge fortune, his share of a huge fortune, and the year after, he gives it all away, mostly to Austrian artists. Although he's actively engaged in Cambridge and joins the Apostles, he nonetheless finds the atmosphere of Cambridge intellectually superficial. Just think about that for a moment. He finds it intellectually superficial at Cambridge. And he then decides to go to Norway, near outside of Bergen, or the end of a field there, to think and to write. When war breaks out, he volunteers for the Austrian army. He didn't have to do that, by the way. He suffered from a double hernia from the year before, so they would have let him off. But nonetheless, he goes, partly out of a sense of duty, but partly, as he says himself, because he thinks that the prospect of facing death will be good for his soul. He thinks that he will find that improving. He's posted to Poland, first working on a kind of a gunboat, operating the searchlight. Sometimes when I read Wittgenstein, I think of that image of Wittgenstein shining the searchlight into the dark forests and wondering what's coming across the banks of the Vistula. He's then sent as a maiden turned into an engineer, and he goes and works in an artillery workshop and is decorated several times. He goes and then goes to Italy, and all the time he's working on material that will eventually become the Tractatus, the topic tonight. A crucial date is June the 11th, 1916, when for the first time, really, he begins to introduce remarks about life and death and God and value into the otherwise quite technical discussions of logic and sense and propositions. He then volunteers to join a howitzer regiment. He's decorated for his activities during the Kerensky Offensive. This is where we find him as a lieutenant on the 1st of February 1918. He comes under fire from the Russians several times, largely because he volunteers for a very dangerous job, namely manning an observation post at night. It's about the most dangerous job he could have done there, really. All the time he continues working on this material. He volunteers to join a howitzer regiment and again is decorated. Again, in November, he's captured by the Italians 1 day before they sign the armistice. But in March of that year, he had pretty much completed the arrangement of his philosophical remarks into a form which is at least very similar to that that we'll take in the final version of the Tractatus. In July of that year, he takes his last leave near Salzburg and completes the manuscript of what will be published in 1922 as the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. In that work, Wittgenstein takes himself to have completed the task of philosophy, and as a result, immediately after the war, he will give up philosophy and become a school teacher in Austria. He will not return to Cambridge until 1929. He will then begin working on a new philosophical approach that is at once a continuation of his early work and, at the same time, a renunciation of it in favour of something new. So that's a kind of sketch of the early life of Wittgenstein in this period.
Thank you so much.
Any questions?
It's obviously an extraordinary philosophical life. I'm just wondering if any of you think, in general, there are traces of that kind of a life in his philosophy. I think the biography is very important to the work, or...
I think that his biography is actually crucial to his work, and it's very telling of his work that he's a philosopher who comes to philosophy very much from the outside, thinking about what is this thing, what is philosophy. I think it's something that marks his entire philosophical life.
It's certainly interesting that he, no undergraduate degree, I mean, a very non-standard route into philosophy. Stephen, do you see any of these?
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. I guess also a crucial aspect of his life that finds expression in the book that you're going to be kind of moving on to in a minute is the way it connects to the culture of the time. I suppose one way of characterizing it would be as a kind of modernist piece of writing. He does seem, in this sense, to reflect some of the streams of culture, particularly in the kind of Austro-Hungarian context that he kind of grew up in. Some of those artists that he gave his money away to. I mean, if you look at the Tractatus, it really doesn't look like the standard form of analytic philosophy of the time. I don't know whether you want me to go more into that or whether that's something you're going to say something about.
We can perhaps come back to it later on. Maybe if I do a kind of overview of the Tractatus now, so I think it's okay. So I think, see, my role here is trying to give a kind of overview of the Tractatus to give you a way in to the book. It consists of seven propositions, all with multiple sub-propositions with an elaborate decimal notation system. It's at once austerely beautiful and technically demanding and very severe. Now, John and Stephen are going to offer a much more nuanced account later on, I hope, than what I'm going to say now. Okay, I'm just trying to get us started on this book. And indeed, this is what I'm going to say is not the path that Wittgenstein took to these ideas. But it's perhaps useful as a kind of rational reconstruction of how someone might get to it. So I'm going to kind of let you into this book by a kind of a side door, as it were, and these guys are going to take you up the front path later on. I think one way to think of the Tractatus is this, that you can see it as the ultimate distillation of a particular historically dominant conception of ourselves that we can all recognise. So picture something like this, that first and foremost, we are conscious thinkers. First of all, we think. And only after are we active, embodied, interacting agents. Before we communicate, the thought might be, you must have something to communicate. We must first be capable of true and false thoughts about the world. To be able to think about things and combinations of things. What in the Tractatus Wittgenstein will call states of affairs. Of course, some of those states of affairs obtain, and some don't. The world consists of all the states of affairs, combinations of things that obtain. We can call those the facts. But we can also represent to ourselves that which doesn't obtain. They're merely possible. So as well as thinking what is true, we can, of course, think what is false. Now, one way to see the question that you can use as a way into the Tractatus is this. How is that possible? That is, what must be the case if we are able to have true and false thoughts about the world? What must be the case if the world is by us thinkable? Wittgenstein's answer in the Tractatus is that the world on the one side and language and thought on the other must share a common form of elements and their arrangement. Wittgenstein will call something that underpins that notion, he will call that logical form in the end. Elements in our representations of the world stand in the same relationship to each other as the elements that constitute the state of affairs it represents. Reality, language, and thought mirror each other. It follows that if we think or say something meaningful, then what we think or say must be capable of being true or false, for only then will it picture a possible fact. Otherwise, what we say or think will be in some way or other non-significant, senseless, in a sense we're going to discuss later on, even nonsensical. We'll come back to those terms. Of course, ordinary language, ordinary thought, doesn't look like that. But Wittgenstein is keen to argue that our complex ordinary thoughts can be analysed down into more elementary thoughts and more elementary propositions. And so there must be a mechanism for producing complex thoughts about the world from simpler ones, from elementary ones. And Wittgenstein identifies this as an operation of recursive negation. That is, applying negation again and again to a proposition and a set made of that proposition and the result of the negation. So it's recursive. So we carry out the same operation repeatedly. Now, in articulating this account of how it is that we can think and speak at all, the Tractatus gives expression, kind of sublime and exact, not it can be argued, in a wholly original way, to a conception of ourselves that's already latent in our intellectual culture. It's a conception of ourselves as representing beings, as minds who represent the world to ourselves. That we think and say things that are true and false, that we have reliable means of acquiring truths about the world, which we can call science. This picture of the nature of mind and of ourselves is really the default conception in our intellectual culture. It dominates, for example, today, the cognitive sciences. Minds are representational engines. That's what we do. The Tractatus can be seen as an attempt to distill that picture. This first order account of the kind of broad brush account of the Tractatus has some interesting implications. Okay? For example, if you think that, I don't know what, dolphins or the great apes, okay, or aliens or AIs for that matter, can ever think, okay, then the same underlying structures must be in operation as Wittgenstein thinks are in operation in our case. So if we study cetaceans or SETI scientists studying alien transmissions, some kind of fantasy like that, then those communications, if they represent anything in the world, will have the same kind of structure and have the same logical form. Notice that structure is entirely independent of the species life of the organism, its environment or such contingencies as how it brings up its young. The possibility of meaning in the Tractatus is logically separated from how in particular creatures it comes about. The only constraint is that the structure allows meaning to be possible. And what's strikingly original about Wittgenstein's account in the Tractatus is the way he draws out some of the implications of this account of how representation is possible. The general constraint that what can be meaningfully said must be structured in this way applies now, first of all, to what philosophers have wanted to claim over millennia. For philosophers make claims not about what happens to be true, but about what must be true. But if the account offered in the Tractatus about how thought works is correct, then those philosophical claims are not capable of being true or false in the relevant sense. They will be, in some sense or other, meaningless. Here's an analogy for you. Okay? I can use chess notation to describe the actual position on a chessboard and describe possible positions on a chessboard. But I can't use chess notation to say how chess notation does that. I needed to go to, in this case, to English to explain how to do that. Okay. The fact that chess notation works shows itself in how it's used to depict those positions. But I can explain it in English. But if we now want to explain how not just any particular natural language, but language and thought as such represents, there's nowhere else I can go to describe how it's done. There is only the showing left. A last implication that we'll come back to very shortly, I'm sure, is about values. Okay? According to the Tractatus, in ethical thought, I am not representing how the world is one way rather than another. So strictly speaking, too, ethical talk will lack sense in the way that our ordinary statements lack sense. Still, according to Wittgenstein, we are ethical beings. The ethical is real. And teaching us how to live in the light of that thought was, Wittgenstein believed, the true aim of the Tractatus. So with the relentless honesty that characterises all of his thinking, Wittgenstein applies that thought to the Tractatus itself. The relationship between thought and the world that the Tractatus articulates is not one amongst the many facts in the world, it's a condition of there being any thinkable facts. So philosophy is a futile attempt to say what cannot be meaningfully said, but can only show itself. Similarly, the propositions of the Tractatus have the same status. They will be, as he says, like rungs on a ladder. You can use them to climb up to a position where you can see the world as it is, you can see the world aright, but then the task is to throw the ladder away. So one of the characteristic and puzzling features of the Tractatus is the way in which its own claims are applied back to itself. Now, my remarks here are also just very bottom rungs on the ladder, and I hope now we can move on and you guys can take them further up that. Thanks very much.
I think Ian has done a brilliant job of giving us an overview of this extraordinarily difficult book. And it is a really special book. It is first of all, it's a very short book for a philosophy book. It's just under 100 pages. It is a very cryptic book. It's all statements are organized in, are numbered, and a very particular order is followed. There are 7 main statements, then other statements are all comments on these statements or comments on those statements, and everything is very mapped out. And when you start looking at it, it has this effect of creating this sense of constant surprise, because you start reading it, and it begins with statements about the world and facts, and you think, oh, all right, I know where I am. I'm going to be given a theory about the world, and the world as the totality of facts. But then it moves on. It moves to thoughts, as Ian mentioned. It moves to language, to propositions, to pictures, to logic, to the natural sciences, psychology, and then towards the end, there are these even more cryptic remarks about value. And so all of that is pretty mysterious, and it's made all the more mysterious by what Wittgenstein then claimed about his own books, about his own book to other people when he spoke to them about it. As Ian mentioned, for example, Wittgenstein told one of his potential publishers that the point of the Tractatus was an ethical one. Right? This book, which is for the most part full of logic, language, the world, facts, all of these terms, Wittgenstein then goes on to tell a potential publisher that actually the point of the book is an ethical one. And there is an even more, I think, to my mind, intriguing remark that he makes. And he makes it in a letter to a close friend and philosophical partner, who's also fighting during the First World War, who's called Paul Engelmann. And in this letter written in January 1918, namely written in the midst of compiling the very final version of the Tractatus, Wittgenstein describes himself to Paul Engelmann as someone who wants to create, someone who wants to invent a, quote, machine for becoming decent. Machine for becoming decent. It is pretty clear from the context of that letter that he's referring to the Tractatus there, so that he's thinking of the Tractatus as a machine for becoming decent. And this is very, very striking, I think. It goes to show that he's partly still thinking of himself, perhaps ironically, as an engineer or a wannabe philosopher who cannot but be an engineer and cannot but create machines, even though he would like to be making philosophy, but he's still just making machines, and the Tractatus is a machine. But it also tells us something very interesting about the way that he understands the role of philosophy and the role that this book that he's writing should have in his view. Because it is a constant theme throughout his philosophical life and still very much present in the Tractatus, that for Wittgenstein, philosophy is an activity. It is something that we do. And what he is doing when he's presenting this view is trying to contrast that with another view of philosophy that Ian has also mentioned to us a moment ago, which we could describe by saying that it's a view of philosophy that says that philosophy is about conveying philosophical information or about conveying philosophical theories. And so there's this distinction between philosophy as the conveying of information of a particular philosophical kind, and philosophy as an activity, where what matters is the activity, not the information that's being transmitted. And I think here, I just wanted to say a little bit more about this distinction, because I think it's very important to the Tractatus in particular. And one of the ways in which we can make the distinction is by drawing on something that was indeed very much part of his background as he was growing up in Vienna, which is just an analogy to do with music. If you imagine the kind of know-how that is required in order to play the piano, on the one hand, the kind of training, practice, action that is required for somebody to be able to play the piano, on the one hand. And on the other hand, information that we can convey to each other, theoretical information that we can convey to each other about what's involved in playing the piano. We can, of course, talk to each other about what is involved in playing the piano. You can say, well, it involves people using two hands and, you know, hitting the keys. You can tell from this I'm not a piano player, by the way. Right. Something like that, some form of information theory. Right? It involves your two hands and keys, right? On the one hand. But that kind of information isn't really going to enable you to know how to play. In order to know how to play, you need to have engaged in a certain type of activity, namely a certain form of practice or training. That is really the kind of distinction that is at work here. And it connects to the idea of the Tractatus as a machine, in that I think Wittgenstein thought very much of the sentences that make up the Tractatus, not as sentences that are meant to convey information, philosophical theses about the world, language, thought, etc., etc., but rather as sentences that we can engage with, that can give us, as philosophers, a form of training. And the training that results from this activity is a training in learning to resist nonsense, or learning to resist philosophical gibberish, philosophical nonsense. And this is the last thing I'll say, and then I will leave the floor to Stephen. Something that is very important to Wittgenstein is that this form of training, learning to knowing, training ourselves to know how to resist philosophical nonsense, for Wittgenstein has a very important ethical dimension. So it makes us ethically better. It makes us ethically decent or more honest with ourselves, and hence the idea that the point of the Tractatus is an ethical one, and that the book might be a machine for becoming decent. So, but
I wonder at this point, could we stop and check in and see if there are any questions? Yeah. Okay, so speak up, because we don't have the roving mic today. So,
just a quick one. Is there any story behind the name Tractatus? It's quite important.
Just inquiring about the point that is a device to make us more decent, since I think the Tractatus says that we cannot really make propositions about ethics. So how far would that give us an insight there, apart from saying what we cannot know about ethics?
Okay, so just for the purposes of recording, so one about the name Tractatus, and then one about decency and sort of propositional role there.
Well, I can happily take the second one, since that's a way into what I'm supposed to talk about. Do you want to say something about the Spinoza?
I think that's probably that. So there certainly seems to be some kind of reference back to Spinoza's ethics going on there, and certainly the way in which the book is structured. And many people have commented on the kinds of overlap there are in content as well as in form between the Tractatus from Wittgenstein and Spinoza's ethics. Whether Wittgenstein was consciously doing that is a harder thing to say.
If I may, I just a tiny addition to that. Mm. I think that the title is like that because he wants us initially to believe that he is going to present us something like a treatise, because the work that he requires us to do in the Tractatus requires that we try to engage with this book as if theses are being presented in front of us, are being presented to us, and to try to take them seriously. And that's how the training starts. So that was just a... Yeah.
So should I maybe say something about the ethical, or do you want to take more questions?
Sure, no, I think it's a good natural way to move in.
Okay, so... So both Ian and Sean have been pointing out that in a certain way this is a very short and a very simple book, and in a certain way it's an incredibly challenging and complex one. You could just summarize it in terms of seven propositions. Right? In a certain way, the form of the text strongly suggests to the reader that if you properly grasp all seven of those propositions, then you've grasped the whole structure of Wittgenstein's thought here. And it takes him most of the book to set up what Ian was describing as a kind of depiction or a picture theory of meaning. Right? All of the apparatus that he needs, a set of claims about the nature of reality and a set of claims about the underlying nature of thought and of language, to make it possible to say, look, the way in which we represent the world, both in our thought and in our language, is such that it's only possible if there's a certain kind of isomorphism, right? A kind of reflection of formal similarity across all three of those domains or media. So by the time you get to proposition six, he kind of summarizes that story about the necessary structure of representation of the world by saying really that the general form of the proposition is things are such and such. Now, on the one hand, that just seems like an incredibly simple thought, you know, maybe even a simplistic thought. You know, if you think about the way ordinary language normally works, it looks as if it works in a whole range of very different ways. Now, it's true that one of the things we do is describe the world, depict it, claim that things are a certain way in the world, and then go and have a look and see whether we've got it right or whether we've got it wrong. You know, we say the cat is on the mat, and well, either it is or it isn't. And the way to find out is to go and look and see whether that real cat is in that relation to that real mat in the real world. That's what, in the philosophical jargon, gets called the sort of bipolarity of a proposition. So we work our way through all of this complex, austere, very minimal and epigrammatic expression. And the thought that pops out at the end of it is propositions depict reality. Right? That, as it were, the paradigm form of representation is the cat sat on the mat. Yeah. And you might think that, you know, the mountain has labored and brought forth a mouse, really. It's hard to see on the basis of that very, very simple thought why this book is so important in the history of analytic philosophy. But you might also think that it's very easy to start thinking of counterexamples. You know, ways in which we use language which just don't seem in any straightforward way to meet that paradigm model. And if you think about it from the point of view of Wittgenstein's later philosophy, where he famously reorients himself methodologically and wants us to look at the meaningfulness of language in terms of the use to which we put words, what he emphasizes in that later phase of his thought is the sheer heterogeneity of language use. So from that kind of perspective, it looks as if the theory of meaning that the Tractatus is offering us as the basis for resolving all the problems of philosophy is an incredibly simple-minded one. Now, that isn't true, but one of the ways in which the book tries to get you to see that it isn't true is that in the final stretches of the book, the sixes, in other words, proposition six and all the propositions that are attached to it, and then finally proposition seven, he does in effect run through very, very quickly a range of possible counterexamples and gives us some clues as to how he would deal with them. Yeah. So within the remarks underneath proposition six, that proposition which just gives us the general form of the proposition as a kind of depiction of possible states of affairs in the world, he then goes on to consider the propositions of logic, the propositions of mathematics, and certain very fundamental formal principles in the domain of natural science, all of which look on the face of it as if they don't meet his bipolarity model, his idea that in order for a proposition to make sense, it has to be capable both of being true and of being false. In other words, it captures something that could be true, but isn't necessarily true. Yeah. Now, if you think about the propositions of mathematics or the propositions of logic, yeah, or the really fundamental formal principles of natural science, what, as it were, holds them together as examples of language use is that they seem to be interested in what you might call the domain of the necessary. Right? If you say that 2 plus 2 equals 4, you don't take that to be just contingently true, right? Something which happens as a matter of fact to be true but could be otherwise. If you think about the principles of logic, again, the thought, the intuitive thought is that you're dealing with the realm of the necessary or the essential. You're not really identifying relationships of inference between propositions that could be otherwise. If they really are a part of logic, then they are necessary.
Wonder how does that relate to the cat on the mat then? Are these just
well, that's exactly right. Cat, yeah, right? Exactly. The thought is if the cat is on the mat is your paradigm of intelligible language use, then the first three sets of topics that Wittgenstein considers in the sixes of the Tractatus are obviously, on the face of it, not forms of language use that seem to straightforwardly meet that model.
So so we have no cats.
Exactly. Yeah. So what kind of story can someone who accepts the picture theory of meaning give to deal with these apparent counterexamples? And you know, as is the way with the Tractatus, Wittgenstein doesn't, as it were, save us the trouble of thinking about it. And I'm not going to go into the details of it. But in each case, he thinks he can tell a story which acknowledges the sense in which these uses of language don't meet the representational paradigm, the picture theory paradigm, the cat sat on the mat paradigm, and yet can be understood as standing in some kind of indirect relationship to those forms of descriptive or pictorial, depictive forms of representation. So although he's quite happy to admit that they're not themselves pictures of anything, he tells a story in each case, a different story in each case, which ties them tightly to the possibility of being able to depict possible states of affairs. Yeah. One example of that tie is what Ian was saying about chess notation. Right? On the one hand, there's what a particular use of chess notation does, which is the depictive story that Wittgenstein wants to give. And then there's the question of how is it so much as possible for there to be a system of notation which allows you to make true or false descriptions of stages in a game of chess. Right? Now, whatever it is that makes that possible, it looks as if we're entering into the domain of the necessary rather than the contingent. Right? The kinds of things that must be this way if it's possible for us to say truly or falsely that the game has reached this particular stage. That would be, as it were, the domain of the propositions of logic. Wittgenstein basically says that logic results from the availability of a pictorial structure in language, because given that pictorial structure, it's possible for you to combine the elements of language in such a way that their content cancels out. Right? On the one hand, I can depict the weather. In English, I can say it's snowing. And it might be true or it might be false. Yeah. But because I have that power in my natural language, it's possible for me to combine elements of English in such a way that the information content cancels out. I end up with a proposition which says either it's snowing or it's not snowing. Right. Now, what happens there is that I've said something by using intelligible elements of English, but I've combined them in such a way that the information cancels out. I haven't really told you anything about the weather if I offer you that proposition. And Wittgenstein basically says that this is how logic is generated, is necessarily generated. If you have a language which is capable of depicting truly or falsely the way things are in the world, if it has that power, then it will also necessarily contain as a kind of subset a way of combining the elements that make up intelligible propositions in such a way that the, as it were, the intelligibility quotient reaches zero. Right? Now that category Wittgenstein calls the senseless. Right? His picture theory of meaning is about what it is for a proposition to have sense, and his story about logic is that logical propositions are propositions which result from combining the elements of this pictorial resource in such a way that the sense cancels out, just reduces to zero. But it's very important for Wittgenstein that to talk about something as senseless is not to call it nonsensical. He draws a very sharp distinction in the book between the intelligible, that which has sense, that which is senseless, and that which is nonsensical. Yeah. So when he's talking about propositions of mathematics, propositions of logic, and the basic formal principles that underlie natural science, these are all potential counterexamples that he tries to tame, and he tames them in certain ways by suggesting that these tie in intelligible ways to the possibility of representation, but they don't lead us into the category of the nonsensical. Right? These are the conditions for the possibility of making sense. You know? But when he moves on within this last part of the book to what he calls the realm of value, and then to what he calls as it were, propositions of philosophy or metaphysical propositions, then we're moving away from the idea of propositions that have sense or have zero sense to the idea of propositions that seem on the face of it, if you read these parts of the book, to be nonsensical propositions. So what's striking here is that ethics is being given a very different kind of treatment to logic, mathematics, and so on. And it's being tied, in the very last moves that are made in the book, to philosophy, to the status of the propositions that make up the Tractatus in the first place. And there he seems to want to say to us, just flatly, that ethical propositions are nonsensical. It's not that, as it were, their sense cancels out to zero in the way of logic. Right? It's that, in some sense, they seem to force us beyond the limits of language. And then he says, right at the end of the book, that the same is true of the propositions of philosophy. Let me just say something briefly about, as it were, the reflections he offers and the status of his own philosophical propositions, and then I'll talk about ethics. Yeah. So think about the distinction I was using a bit earlier between the realm of the contingent or the accidental and the realm of the necessary. Yeah. If the paradigmatic use of language that you're focusing on in your story about representation is, as it were, fact-stating discourse, right? Attempts to represent the way things are in the world, which may be true or may be false, what you're really dealing with there is the realm of the contingent. Right? The way things are organized in the world is, as it were, not indefinitely, but certainly to a very large extent, open to rearrangement. Yeah, things that are a certain way might have been a completely different way. Yeah? Maybe it is snowing right now outside. Maybe it isn't. Both of those possibilities are available. And the only way in which we can work out whether we've got it right is by going out and having a look at the way the states of affairs of the world actually are, the ones we're trying to represent. Yeah? But when we're doing metaphysics, when we're doing philosophy, as Ian was saying right at the beginning, what we take ourselves to be trying to identify are things that could not be otherwise. Right? These things have to be the way they are. This is why philosophers from Plato onwards think about themselves as trying to identify the essence of things. Right? The kinds of properties or nature that things must have if they're going to be the kinds of things that they are. And in a certain way, that's what the whole of the Tractatus is doing. It's trying to understand the essence, the essential nature of representation. How it's so much as possible for us to depict reality in thought or language. Well, whatever those conditions turn out to be, they're not contingent, right? They couldn't be other than they are. Because if they were other than they are, then representation would be impossible, right? So the domain of philosophy looks as if, as it were, its subject matter has to do with essence. It has to do with things that could not be otherwise. And if you step back a bit from the Tractatus and look at what it's telling us, Wittgenstein doesn't take us to be representing things as being a certain way when they could have been some other way. On the contrary, he takes himself to be telling us what must be the case if representation is to be possible. But then the propositions that make up the Tractatus are not bipolar, right? They're not functioning in the depictive manner that the book claims any genuinely intelligible proposition has to function. Yeah. So on the face of it, Wittgenstein is kind of sawing off the branch on which he's sitting. Right? If it's essential to intelligibility that you be focused on the contingent, on things that could have been otherwise, and yet here is a whole book consisting of propositions which are identifying as their subject matter things that could not be otherwise, then the logical conclusion is that none of these propositions make any sense. Right? And what's, as it were, amongst the most fascinating of the paradoxical features of the Tractatus is that Wittgenstein doesn't try to brush this under the carpet. It's not that he missed it. It's not that he kind of realized it but tried very hard to hide it. He ends the book by saying, anyone who understands me will understand that my propositions are nonsensical. He offers that as a criterion for appreciating what the book is trying to do. Right? So you can sort of see the problem, right? I mean, this would normally be what a philosopher would call a reductio ad absurdum of a philosophical theory. You know, if one of the implications of your theory, if it were true, is that you couldn't articulate it intelligibly, then it doesn't look like a very viable philosophical theory. And by the way, how could you even so much as understand what one of its logical implications was? Right? In order to understand that, you'd have to make sense of the propositions. And what have the three of us been doing for the last three quarters of an hour? But trying to give you an accurate depiction of the theory of meaning that the Tractatus is built around. Yeah. So on the face of it, Wittgenstein is kind of running into a brick wall. But he welcomes this. You know, he positively welcomes it. He doesn't just declare that this is the case. He offers it as a criterion for correctly understanding the project he's engaged in, that by the time you work your way to the end of the book, you realize that the status of the propositions you've been struggling with is that of nonsense. Right? They're not bipolar. They don't have sense in the way that the cat sat on the mat has sense. They're not like logic. They're not like mathematics. They're not like the formal principles of natural science, although they share the interest in necessity. They're not in the domain of the senseless or zero sense. They're in the domain of the nonsensical. So anyone who tries to make sense of this book is facing a real problem at that point. How can it be the case that constructing nonsensical propositions could be, as it were, part of an intelligible philosophical project? Right? Now, one clue that John was really kind of gesturing towards in the remark she made is that the only other kind of proposition that gets that kind of treatment are the propositions of ethics. They, too, are thought of as taking us towards a domain of necessity, but they're also being explicitly characterized as nonsensical.
Is this ethics quite broadly construed at this point?
Right.
Religion and everything else is in there with it?
Yeah. So one way of trying to get a grip on what's going on in that very short portion of the book that's talking about value is, I think, to go a little bit outside the book, because when Wittgenstein came back to philosophy in the late 20s, one piece of writing that was due to be published, but which I think he withdrew, didn't he, before it was delivered, was a lecture on ethics. And I think if I can just say a bit about what he tries to do in that lecture, it might help those of you who go back to the Tractatus and have a look at the kinds of remarks he makes about value and what he calls the mystical in this very late stretch of the book. And then it might help to understand why John is so convinced, I think rightly, that something about the problematic status of philosophical propositions and the status Wittgenstein attributes to ethics mean that those two things are internally related. In other words, that the book has an ethical point. Yeah? So the crucial distinction in the lecture on ethics is one he draws between relative value and absolute value. A judgment or a proposition of relative value is my saying, this is a good table. Right? Or I might say, if you want to get from Paddington to Euston Square, the Circle Line is the best tube line to use. Right? These are all very familiar, everyday uses of evaluative discourse. And Wittgenstein characterizes them as judgments of relative value because the point of making them, the intelligibility of these kinds of judgments, is dependent upon their relationship to some specific goal or purpose that you might have. Right? What makes a table a good table is that it's flat, it's stable, because there are certain things one wants to do with tables. One wants to be able to put books on them, to put a glass of water on them without it spilling, and so on and so forth.
Relative to your needs or something.
Exactly, yeah. So That means that you can deny that it's a good table if those aren't the purposes or the goals that you have at that particular point. Maybe what you want to have is the most fashionable table. Yeah? Or maybe you want the table to be a work of art rather than something that allows you to put books stably on its surface. Yeah? But and there's a kind of slightly different way of making that point about relativity, which is that insofar as a judgment is a judgment of relative value, then it bears a certain kind of relationship to the realm of fact. Right? Because it means that the judgment is one that's only going to apply if certain things are true of you. Right? Namely, that you have the desire to put books stably on the surface as opposed to the desire to be fashionable or the desire to have works of art rather than utilitarian objects in your lecture hall. Yeah. Now, Wittgenstein is not saying there's anything wrong with those kinds of relative evaluative judgment, but basically that's not what he's interested in. What he's interested in is what he calls judgments of absolute value. And as you might tell from the label, the thing about absolute judgments of value is that they are not relative. They are unconditional. Their intelligibility does not depend upon the presence in the context of some particular goal or purpose, or upon the empirical fact that you have a certain desire or a certain kind of interest in whatever it is that's being evaluated. Now, in a certain way, that distinction is intuitively quite plausible, I think. You know, suppose you find someone telling a lie and you criticize them. You say that was a bad thing to do. That's really bad behavior on your part. And suppose they respond by saying, well, I don't particularly want to behave well. You know, I think most of us intuitively would think that's not a legitimate reason for rejecting my judgment of your lying behavior. I don't care whether or not you want to behave well. You should behave well. You know? So the idea that there's a kind of dimensional register of evaluative judgment that is unconditional or absolute is one that I think most of us have some kind of intuitive sense for. But part of what Wittgenstein is doing in the lecture is pointing out how puzzling these kinds of judgments actually are. Because if you try to understand their logic by comparing them to relative evaluative judgments, then they become completely impossible to understand. Right? Because if what makes a judgment of relative value intelligible is the ties that it always relies upon to existing goals or purposes and to particular psychological facts about you, and then you start making judgments using exactly the same term, right, good and bad, but deliberately severing those judgments from any kind of relativity to goals or purposes or the presence or absence of desires in your psyche, what on earth is going on?
Steve, I wonder if it's worth at this point, it's worth saying that that's not a distinction that Wittgenstein is kind of inventing at this point. It's a long tradition in ethics, certainly in Kant, for example. We have the idea of hypothetical imperatives and categorical imperatives, and that's that distinction that's puzzling, because we have the idea of a kind of moral necessity, the moral must. And that's the thing that Wittgenstein's interested in, not our particular, you say, real terms, relative demands, but these absolute, unconditional, categorical demands.
Yeah, so what you've got there is a kind of a register of necessity.
Yeah,
right? Necessity. Yeah. And that's what brings the treatment of judgments of value, propositions of value in the Tractatus back within the context of the sixes.
Yeah.
Right, as I was saying a bit earlier. But as it were, in the lecture on ethics, he tries to demonstrate to his audience that there's something deeply puzzling about this intuitively natural understanding of the ethical. Yeah? In the context of the Tractatus, it comes out precisely because we're looking at all of these potential counterexamples, having been told that the paradigm case of intelligible language is fact-stating discourse, right? Well, the one thing judgments of absolute value are not, one would think, are statements of fact, right? And that means, as the as the lecture on ethics puts it, we can't explain what they mean by contextualizing them in the realm of the empirical. Yeah? But then how are we supposed to make sense of them? Yeah? And what Wittgenstein says in the lecture on ethics, in effect, is we can't. We can't make sense of them, and we shouldn't make sense of them. In fact, he goes a step further. He says, the only reason for making them is that they don't make any sense.
Yes, he gives an example in that lecture of the miracle. You know, he speaks about, imagine that suddenly in this room, one of us grew a lion's head, right? And something that could be described as miraculous. From a certain perspective, it could be described as miraculous. And he then goes on to say, well, if it were me, and he speaks in the first person, I think that's very interesting. If it were me, what I would do in that situation is go and try and have this person scientifically studied. If it weren't for the fact that I would be hurting them, I would vivisect them to see what's gone on here. And then he says, but if I did that, I would be missing out entirely on what is ethical or religious or miraculous about the situation. So there's the idea, it's not just that the ethical or the religious cannot be put into words, it's that if you try to treat it like all of the other things that we do put into words in natural science, for instance, or in everyday life, then you just lose its ethical dimension or its religious dimension. You lose the miracle if you treat it like that.
So I suppose the crucial thing to bear in mind is that when Wittgenstein says, I'm offering you this account of judgments of value, he doesn't mean all judgments of value. He doesn't mean judgments of relative value. They're fine. Insofar as you can tell a story about them which ties them back to the realm of the empirical, to the world of states of affairs that might be one way and might not be, then that's absolutely no kind of counterexample to his picture theory of meaning. But if you take seriously the idea of a dimension of ethics in which the absolute or the unconditional is at work, then you've got a real problem in trying to make it compatible with the story about representation that the whole book seems designed to deliver to you. Now, of course, you know, one way in which one might try to handle the problem is by saying, actually, they are representational. They're just representations of, as it were, the supernatural. You know, that which lies beyond the realm of the factual. Right? And in a certain way, that's what Kant does when he puts so much emphasis on the idea of unconditional obligations. He ends up having to talk about the transcendental aspect of the self rather than the empirical aspect of the self. And there is a remark in the Tractatus at this point where Wittgenstein says ethics is transcendental. The trouble is the term transcendental in the Tractatus doesn't mean what Kant takes it to mean, because in the only previous use of that term in the book is applied to the propositions of logic. And remember, they belong to the category of the senseless. They have to do with the limits of the world, the factual world. They're not claiming to go beyond. And of course, this idea that there is a realm of ethical value beyond the realm of states of affairs, the factual realm, it just looks like an option that the Wittgenstein of the Tractatus couldn't possibly take. Right? Because after all, if we were capable of representing both, as it were, empirical facts and evaluative facts, well, then the evaluative facts would just be part of the world of states of affairs. We wouldn't be talking about what we thought we were talking about, because the atmosphere of unconditionality or necessity would have been lost. Right? If we can represent ethical value, then it must be contingent. But it can't be contingent, because then it wouldn't be genuinely ethical value. So he doesn't really have that escape route. Yeah? So the question is, what kinds of costs and benefits are attached to regarding ethical evaluative propositions as nonsensical? if they really are simply devoid of any intelligibility, if we can't do anything with them, why don't we just stop talking about the ethical? Right? After all, as you were beginning to explain a bit earlier, that seems to be what he wants to do with propositions of philosophy. The only other category of proposition that he says belongs to the nonsensical. When Sean was talking about the book as a kind of machine for being decent, for being honest with yourself, part of what she was capturing there was the idea that it's the act of reading it and thinking your way through it is designed to get you to the point of seeing that where you thought there was something intelligible, there wasn't. But the moral that you're supposed to draw from that is stop trying to construct metaphysical propositions.
So the decency is a decency of integrity, almost, kind of.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
there is. It's very interesting because it's both that it is by its very nature not possible to describe the ethically valuable in language, but it's also, I think, that there is something unethical about taking oneself as... or there's something dishonest or unethical about believing oneself to be in a position where one could present or develop theories about such fundamental things as ethics. And there's something similar going on, I think, with metaphysics. I think that there's something fundamentally dishonest about, for instance, developing a metaphysical theory that says that I, the subject, am the condition of the world. It puts me, the subject, in a position of enormous privilege in connection to the world. I'm saying I'm the condition of the world. I am what makes the world possible. To Wittgenstein, that's Marx of it's a philosophical theory. It's an attempt at putting forward something that might look like philosophical information. You know, the world is made possible by the eye, right? Here I am informing you of the fact that I am the condition of the world. The subject is the condition of the world, right? But in so doing, it's doing something that actually turns out to be gibberish, turns out to be nonsensical. And in the attempt to develop that as a theory, it is, in his view, is dishonest. It conveys a distorted understanding of what, for example, my position really is in the world. So
when one of the famous remarks at the end of the Tractatus is that, you know, the mystical concerns not how the world is, but the sheer fact that the world is. And the mystical is this domain of absolute value, it seems to me. That's the most plausible way of taking it. So, as it were, there is a kind of domain of evaluative judgment within the world which has to do with how the world is. You know, if I say this is a good table, then whether I'm right or wrong depends on certain properties that the table either has or lacks. But then there's this whole other register of ethical thought and experience, which seems to take us into a completely different realm, which seems on the one hand to be dependent upon the same terminology, but deliberately deprives that terminology of the conditions of intelligibility that normally give it the sense and the point and the purpose that it has in our lives. So when Wittgenstein talks about value in the Tractatus, he's really talking about something that he tries to capture in various ways. He starts talking about the sense of the world or the problem of life. And one of the things he says at this late stage in the Tractatus is that the solution to the problem of life consists in the dissolution of it as a problem. You know, you don't find an answer to the problem of life. what shows that life is no longer a problem for you is that you don't see any question being posed by the life you lead. So what he seems to be talking about is, as it were, you know, how is it so much as possible for our existence to mean anything? You know, to have purpose or point, to have significance or value. And in a certain sense, that's a more fundamental issue for him than the question of whether this is a good table or whether the Circle Line is the best way to get from Paddington to Euston Square. That in a certain sense, all of those evaluative judgments are kind of dependent on the world as such having a meaning. Yeah. And all of a sudden we get, you know, this outbreak of mysticism, of the kind of Tolstoyan cultural material that you were talking about. You know, it was the Gospels that was in Wittgenstein's back pocket in the front line in the First World War. And most people who read the tractatus kind of think, how on earth did we get into all this after spending most of the book trying to work out how it's possible for thought to represent reality? You know, whereas for Wittgenstein, this is where you're really getting to the heart of the matter for him. If you don't understand what's being driven at by the nonsensicality of ethics, and you don't recognize the equal nonsensicality of the propositions that philosophy keeps on trying to construct, you've completely missed the point of the book.
I might pause at this point to see if we have any questions from the audience.
Yeah, we've got one here and one there at least. Okay, so can you speak clearly?
I have read that he was raised Roman Catholic and he had Jewish and Anglican background. Mm. And then you did mention there about the Gospels being in his pocket and mysticism. So would his search be for the understanding of an approach to ethics that sometimes seems contradictory in the Bible as a demand from God to behave in the Hebrew scriptures, and then as Jesus who says, you just love me and then you'll be able to love? Is he grappling with that? And the idea of, and for that we need the idea of mysticism, because if Jesus is asking, if you love me, you'll be able to love, then that implies a mystic approach to it.
Okay, thank you. And then we'll just go to this one as well. And then
right, yeah. This might be a bit of a leap, but a lot of what you were talking about kind of reminded me of the Tao Te Ching, because in one of the statements in the Tao Te Ching is that the true Tao is the Tao that cannot be spoken.
Yeah.
So given that kind of line of thinking, do you guys reckon at all that Wittgenstein might be in doubt?
Okay, and then one last question here, and then we'll try and take them all back. So you yourself with the glasses.
I guess the representation of the Tao on the map obviously lacks context to start with, right? And it's not dynamic. And it doesn't represent the state of the observer at the time of making the comment. The comment by the observer is left out in terms of their senses as being trying to attempt to explain some sort of philosophical concept. And in doing that, they're leaving themselves out. And always there's a distortion in terms of representation. Because with distorting, if you see the table there, who represent the table, the table is happening within the context of people and all sorts of other things that it would be totally impossible to represent in any case. And they're always only seeing one side of something, only seeing a fraction of it. We can go around it 100 times and still we've got the whole. So we're using the concept to evaluate things. And if we're asked to remember, well, what exactly did you see there? Well, what do you mean? The actual sensory experience, complete washout. We've left out most of what was there.
Okay, so we've got one question on Wittgenstein's sort of unorthodox, maybe religious background, lots of different influences there. How does that intersect with ethics and religion? One question on the Tao that can't be spoken, whether that could be a relatable theme. And then the observer and representation and maybe how much we need to be in a position of observing to make sense of certain kinds of representation.
Can
we maybe just deal with these ones first? Because
it may take some time.
Okay.
In the mystical approach, in his mystical approach, I can only see that he's dealing with the place of the world in all this value and ethical system and how he's sort of coming to the conclusion when the world is, and then I'm interested in ethics, it seems to be a very Catholic, at least, otherwise I'm Lutheran and Jewish. So I think I can see everything there in him. So maybe
over to you guys.
Okay, so I hope it's clear that what's going on here, that partly the difficulty of the Tractatus is, first of all, understanding, as it were, the first order claims being made on that account. And then, as Stephen and Sean have been stressing, understanding what point there is in making those claims, what he's trying to do with those claims. And that's the bit where we end up with claims about nonsense and about the ethical point of it. And certainly, if we go along with the kind of story that Stephen and Sean are telling us, is very persuasive in many ways. You do seem to end up with a kind of quietism, okay, or something that looks akin to a kind of Zen, like a Zen koan or something. That's a series of those, okay. And so that it's not the content of the Zen koan that matters, but its effect on somebody. It's like being struck by the ruler, okay, and bang you over the head with spectators, okay. And so that the content of the propositions in the Tractatus will be, in the end, completely irrelevant, so long as they have that effect. Okay? And that is a reading of the Tractatus that's in many ways very plausible. I have to say I don't go along with much of that. Okay? And that I think if that were true, then claims that Wittgenstein makes much later in his life about how much he disagrees with what's going on in the Tractatus would themselves be senseless. So very often he wants to distance himself from the tractate, from claims being made there. And he wanted, for example, to publish the Philosophical Investigations, first of all, with the title, The Philosophical Investigations Set Against the Tractatus. If it were true that the only reading of the Tractatus was one that led us into a kind of Zen-like state, I don't see how that would make any sense. So I certainly think this is an element in the reading of it. I think it can be overdone in some readings. But that's what there's room for disagreement about that. Can I come back on the observer thing, if I have a different way into that? So if we take, just for the moment, go back to the kind of picture theory of meaning and look at kind of sideways on view that might help with the observer point. Okay? What we have in the kind of nominal first order view, okay, which we may later take a different view about in terms of its nonsensical status, the view that here is a set of elements representing a state of affairs in the world. We have one fact, namely the relationship between names, okay, in a proposition, and things in the world, and one is representing the other. A question to ask is, why don't we say that the fact represents the proposition? Why is it that way around? We might, for example, Wittgenstein would be very relaxed about how we spell out how the elements in the proposition are instantiated. It's perfectly consistent for him to say, he wouldn't have said, but it would be consistent to say that they are neural encodings. That would have been fine. He didn't care about that, the psychology or the physiology of that at all. But why do we say that the facts about the brain state represent the fact in the world and not the other way around? There's an asymmetry involved. Okay? There's an arrow, as it were, that points from the proposition to the world. That asymmetry looks completely uncapturable, okay, in philosophy, okay, or in the theory offered in the Tractatus. So that seems to do with the status of the subject, the I, okay, which can't itself be represented. So the I's relationship to the world can't itself be represented, and just shows itself in the fact that, well, what? That we live, that we're alive. In a way, that's a kind of natural ethical outcome of that position. So maybe that joins the two. Okay, there is a kind of Zen-like state, which we get to, which will in the end show itself in, not so much in quietism, but in a kind of practical commitment to doing things. As we find, for example, in Buddhism, the upshot of that is a kind of compassion for other people. Okay, a practical compassion. And that might be an ethical outcome. It's no coincidence that Wittgenstein throughout his life didn't like theology of any kind. Okay? But he didn't like religious institutions. But he did think that there was something absolutely admirable about the religious attitude towards life and the ability of people leading a Christian, in this case, Christian life. So it was kind of practical, a kind of practical faith that emerges from it in the end, a kind of compassionate faith in the end, which is a bit far removed from just a kind of Zen-like emptiness.
I'd like to say something about that, because I don't know enough about Taoism specifically, but there are definitely similarities between the Dharma, the idea of how the Dharma is supposed to, in Buddhism, is supposed to operate, and this idea of a machine for becoming decent, in that there's certainly... in both cases, the idea is you don't become a better person by being told or given information. You become a better person by engaging in certain practices or engaging in certain activities. I strongly disagree with the idea that the outcome would be anything like a state. The outcome is very much not... anything like being in a state. It is much more something about acting with a certain understanding of yourself, of your place in the world, of etc. So it connects with more with your, I think, the idea of practical
compassion,
understanding. But to connect with to your question. Actually, it is very striking that what is absolutely missing here is love and compassion. I mean, and I'm not sure that it even occurred to him that that might be a dimension at this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one doesn't have to go towards Eastern forms of religion and mysticism, because there is a kind of Christian tradition of mysticism. You know, all things shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. And I think part of what Wittgenstein is getting at the end of the Tractatus, when he talks about the world of the happy man and the world of the unhappy man, is that he's gesturing towards that kind of difference. So that there's a kind of fundamental ethical distinction he seems to want to draw between people for whom, as it were, worldly existence as such is perfectly acceptable, utterly unproblematic, and people for whom it's just deeply and irremediably problematic. You know? This is not I've got to get myself from Euston Square to Paddington this evening, what's the best way to do it? It's not that kind of ethical problem. It's the kind of problem that... Well, Cora Diamond, who's a Wittgenstein scholar who has a lot of interesting things to say about the Tractatus... suggests that there's quite a strong analogy here between the kind of point Wittgenstein's trying to make about absolute value and relative value, and the kind of point that quite often gets made in fairy tales, in Grimm's fairy tales, for example. So she talks about the tale of the flounder's wife, the fisherman's wife and the flounder. Right? The fisherman rescues the flounder. The flounder says, "I'll grant you your wishes." And the fisherman and his wife are living at the moment in a kind of pigsty, really, really horrible hovel. So the first wish that the fisherman's wife articulates is to get a better house. And the fisherman goes back to the flounder and says, "Can you do this for us?" The flounder says, "Fine." Next time it's a bigger request. He goes to the flounder and says, "Okay, fine." And then eventually the fisherman's wife gets to the point of saying, "Look, I'm really not happy with the fact that the sun rises and sets without my permission." Now, what Cora Diamond says is that the fisherman's wife is an unhappy person. Right? It's not that the arrangement of certain objects or states of affairs in the world makes her unhappy, whereas other arrangements of those same objects would make her happy. What makes her unhappy is, as it were, the world as such. The fact that it's there, that it exists independently of her will. Right? So, as it were, every aspect of it constitutes a source of unhappiness for her. The sheer fact that she has to live in the world is the problem when you get right down to the tale. And as a result, the flounder, as it were, punishes her. Right? There's a cosmic storm in the story and she ends up back in the hovel. Everything gets destroyed. And what Diamond claims And it seems to me there's some plausibility in this, although it obviously raises difficulties of its own, is that there is a kind of ethical problem that has to do with whether or not one can just accept the world, right? Not which particular problems one finds deeply irritating, which ones one finds fairly superficial and easy to handle, but as it were, there's a really fundamental level at which for some people, maybe for all of us some of the time, what we find puzzling and hard to make any sense of is just that sheer fact that there we are, having to live a life, having to make all these kinds of decisions, and why on earth does any of it matter?
Right? But also accepting kind of finitude.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So the point here is not so much quietism, exactly, so much as whether it's part of ethical life, one part of ethical life, to kind of struggle about that. Struggle about whether you're willing to accept your own finitude, whether you're willing to accept the independence of the world from your will. Never mind whether or not you can succeed in the projects that your will decides are important, but whether you can actually really accept the fact that these relative ethical problems are all occurring within a context that simply constitute the limits of human existence.
I suppose for most people that will show itself in their attitude towards death. Okay, so insofar as for most of us, when we contemplate our own mortality and get nearer to it, okay, those sorts of thoughts come to mind. And the thought that it's just so unfair that I have to die, okay, that kind of thought, which perhaps we're all prone to, is one in which this kind of, which is a kind of sin, as it were, that we've been talking about, comes to the fore for most of us.
Yeah, and this would fit with John's theory or thesis about the connection between his treatment of the ethical and his treatment of philosophy, right? Because if what's at issue here is whether or not you're made happy or unhappy by the fact that there are conditions under which you live your life, then, you know, some of the most fundamental of those conditions have to do with the very limits of logic and language that the rest of the book is concerned to try and delineate and reflect as accurately as possible.
A very unfortunate condition of my life right now is to say that we're at time. So it just remains to thank our speakers very much.